Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Happy Friday. It's 4 o'clock in New York. There is brand new reporting on what happened after. Special Counsel Jack Smith got his hands on that bombshell tape recording of Donald Trump discussing a classified military document about Iran. It's reporting that underscores deep concerns on the part of the Justice Department that after more than a year of stonewalling by Team Trump, a court-mandated search of Mar-a-Lago and a subpoena, after all of that, Donald Trump still might have classified documents in his possession. Two sources telling CNN this, quote, attorneys for Donald Trump turned over material in mid-March in response to a federal subpoena related to a classified U.S. military document described by the former president on tape in 2021, but were unable to find the document itself. That subpoena from Jack Smith reportedly came after the special counsel's team questioned a Trump aide before a federal grand jury about the tape, in which Trump expresses his frustrations with General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. More from that reporting, quote, prosecutors sought any and all documents and materials related to Mark Milley and Iran, including maps or invasion plans, sources say. The sources also say that prosecutors made clear to Trump's attorneys after issuing the subpoena that they specifically wanted the Iran document he talked about on tape, as well as any material referencing classified information, things like meeting notes, audio recordings, or copies of the document that may still be in Trump's possession. The subpoena and the failure by Trump's attorneys to find the document reflects longstanding concerns by DOJ that not all classified documents have been returned. Even late last year, months after the Mar-a-Lago search, attorneys for Donald Trump found two classified documents in a storage unit in West Palm Beach. Now, the subpoena also underscores just how Jack Smith's team is intent on nailing down every aspect of the story around what could amount to smoking gun evidence, given just how important the tape might be in any potential criminal case against Trump. As the New York Times reports, quote, during the conversation, Trump signaled his awareness of his inability to declassify the document because he'd already left office. Trump's advisors have argued that Trump, while still in office, had declassified all the material he took with him when he left. New details on efforts by Jack Smith to pin down the facts involving an audio recording of Donald Trump talking about a classified military document is where we begin today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Katyal is back. Also joining us, former RNC Chairman Michael Steele and New York Times Washington correspondent Mike Schmidt is also here, all MSNBC contributors. Mike, your colleagues have some new reporting on the story we lead with, that the lawyers for Trump are unable to locate or ascertain any location for this document.
Look, we can't see fully into this investigation. We now know about this very intriguing audio file in which he's discussing this document. One of the problems with Donald Trump is because he makes so many things up and says so many different things, it makes investigating him difficult. And look, we don't know like what this document is or where it is, but would it be beyond Donald Trump to have like said that, you know, he had something in his hands that he didn't have in his hands? Of course. Donald Trump has, you know, said blatantly false things about very obvious things. It also speaks to the difficulty of investigating Donald Trump's world, because if this was, you know, a regular president and they had their documents that they happened to have taken from the White House, they probably would keep them in some sort of fashion. They'd probably be in one place. There'd be
Mike Pence or
someone who would really be in charge of it and such. But as we know, they've had to look at Mar-a-Lago. They had to look at a storage facility down in Florida. They had to look at in Bedminster to see if it was there. It's just such a chaotic and disorganized place. And in some ways, I think that that probably helps Trump, because you're not investigating the hierarchy at the top of a of an institution that has well-established lanes of the road, and it's pretty clear who does what and knows what. But you have folks like Walt Nauta, like who was a personal assistant. Was he a, he was a valet. What is a valet? What do these people do? What are their roles? Who do they work with? Who do they work for? And if you're watching at home, it can be very confusing, because we're deep inside the bowels and underbellies of like how the world around Donald Trump functions. And it's confusing.
Your colleagues have an analysis piece out, though, that make clear that just Trump being on tape in his own voice, acknowledging that there exists a declassification process, and the document, whether he had it or not, hadn't been declassified, could amount to some devastating evidence on its own.
Correct. And especially if they're able to show exactly what the document was. Now, they could run into a difficult place if they're not able to figure out where the document is. I mean, the fact that they can't find it is a hugely beneficial thing to Donald Trump, because it's like, well, what is the document? What was he specifically talking about? And look, all classified document cases, document retention cases, are very difficult because you really have to prove that these people had these things and they knew they shouldn't have. There's certainly a lot of evidence of that that has come out throughout the entire investigation. But what I'd like to know is like, well, what does the government do when they come back and say, we can't find the document? Because it probably means it wasn't in the boxes that were returned. Why else would they be asking for something if they thought that they already had it? So where is it?
Neil Katyal, the analysis reporting in The Times makes clear that Trump on tape acknowledging that he had items that hadn't been declassified by him or anybody else could potentially blow a hole through all of the public defenses. Now, as Mike's saying, there may be other legal defenses. It seems to always boil down to this stupid and chaotic defense if the past is prologue. But what do you make of what is known to be evidence that Jack Smith has put before the grand jury?
Well, Nicole, I have to say that classified documents about Iran are pretty high up on the list of things that you don't want to lose at a country club. And I'm going to say something here that I don't think I'll ever generally say. I disagree with Mike and I agree with Bill Barr. That is to say that I think actually this is not a hard case to prove, this prosecution. And if anything, it's easier to make a case against Trump than it is against others, because Trump is his own worst enemy when it comes to his legal troubles. He opens his mouth in all sorts of ways that implicate him even further. So I don't think Mike is right when he says the question here is whether or not they can find this document about Iran. They're already found more than 100 classified documents and sensitive documents at Mar-a-Lago after they swore that Trump had turned over everything. So whether or not they find this document or not, that's not what the prosecution is going to be based on. The relevance of this whole story and this tape is not for the document itself. It goes to Trump's state of mind. The defense that he's been articulating ever since the search on Mar-a-Lago is, I declassified this stuff in my mind. I had a standing order when I took stuff out of the White House. It was automatically declassified. Now, that argument has always struck me as bogus, but here you have Donald Trump on tape saying it's bogus, saying, look, there's a document I took out of the White House, and that document is classified, therefore I can't show it to you. That blows a hole in the defense. So that's why I think it's relevant. And I think the question about whether this document can be found or not, whether Trump exerted incompetence with respect to that document or, you know, mishandled that document, that's an interesting question. Prosecutors, of course, should get to the bottom of it. But the real question, the real point is they found the goods. They found more than 100 classified documents at his house after he swore they didn't. And his one defense that he's been articulating ever since the search is now contradicted by his own words. It's as if Donald Trump is too dumb to even play dumb, which was his defense.
Let me show you. Interestingly, Neil, he has never said, I don't have this document. He's never said, I don't have classified materials. He's never said, I kept things I shouldn't have kept. I mean, he doesn't deny the aspects of the conduct that are described as the crimes under investigation, all the way up to and including the Espionage Act. Did you show it to anyone? Not really. That's his answer to, you know, dissemination, which puts him in some danger under the letter of the Espionage Act. Let me play you another attempt that he made in an edited broadcast by Fox News last night. So we don't know if this was even the whole answer, but here's some of his answer to Sean Hannity about this document specifically.
The third issue is there's a special counsel that's appointed, and news broke yesterday that there might be a tape recording that, quote, where you acknowledge that you understood that these were classified documents. First of all, do you know who this call may be with? Do you know anything about it?
No, I don't know anything about it. All I know is this. Everything I did was right. We have the Presidential Records Act, which I abided by 100%. Biden has 1,850 boxes with a lot of classified stuff that he's not supposed to have. In his case, I have the right to declassify as president.
Again, the misdirection. I mean, the call was with Mark. These aren't mysterious facts. They've been all over the news for 2 days. The call was with the recording was for an autobiography that Mark Meadows was drafting. It was his ghostwriter. He's on the tape. He's not secretly recorded. He's crinkling a piece of paper. And it seems that he's missing what endangers him, which is that he, in his own voice, and we just saw in the E. Jean Carroll trial, that in his own voice, copping to believing that for a million years you could grab women between the legs because that's what famous people do, and that's still his position today. What he's copping to in all of these taped appearances is not a denial that he took classified information. And there's never a denial that he obstructed the government's efforts to have the classified material made secure again.
That's exactly right, Nicole. And that is his entire answer last night. I had to suffer through that and watch that thing. And yeah, you've got it exactly right. I mean, you know, I used to be national security advisor at the Justice Department. I handled these kinds of documents all the time. And I can tell you, when someone asks you, did you ever disseminate a piece of classified information? You darn well know who you talked to classified information with and who you did. It's not the kind of thing you forget and say, not really, or something like that. If this were any other person and they had admitted to what Donald Trump's already admitted to, they'd be in jail. This is not a hard case. And that is why, ultimately, I think the trajectory of this investigation, based on everything we know and how the case gets stronger and stronger with new pieces of information, makes it very hard for Jack Smith to do anything else but to indict. Because if it were anyone else, there would be an indictment already.
Michael Steele, I want to bring you in on this. On the town hall, what was broadcast was not broadcast live. That's all I meant. And there's some opportunity for any news organization taking something that's pre-taped to make edits. We don't have any information that they edited this particular section, but we don't know what his full answer was. But to Neil's point, it never really changes. He says, I had the Presidential Act, the Presidential Records Act. Presidential Records Act isn't a pocket pardon for mishandling classified documents.
No, it's not at all. But before I address it, I just have to give a drop the mic moment to my man Neil for the key analysis of Donald Trump. Too dumb to play dumb. It was such a perfect assessment of everything we've known from 2015 to the present. So here we are. In this moment, watching this recording with Sean, and folks actually, from a political perspective, taking this seriously and being concerned about what the outcome of this may mean for Trump, what this may mean for Republicans. Trump doesn't care about any of that. As Sean asked the question, the answer was already forming in his lips before he finished the question. And that is, he genuinely believes, too dumb to recognize the truth here, that he has the authority to just do whatever he wants with classified information. And the problem is that there is nobody inside the Republican political or legislative class, all right, who said to him, no, you don't. The Congress wrote the law. I mean, this is not something. The presidents didn't write the Espionage Act. Members of Congress wrote the law. They set the parameters and they put the limit on the president's ability to just wake up in the middle of the night and think, oh, you know what? I'm going to declassify that document on Iran. It's declassified, and go back to sleep. That's just not how it works. And so, but Trump persists in this, and there is no relevant pushback on it. So what that means is that when the hammer comes down on this, you're going to have a significant population of people out there who are going to think Donald Trump is getting screwed again, that Donald Trump has the authority to do what he did with those documents. And so we find ourselves having these very erstwhile and important legal discussions around the ramifications of these actions. But the political consequences when it comes time to how the American people are digesting this, because as a recovering lawyer, I can tell you they digest politics better than they digest the law. You know, they're just not going to be on the same page. And that's one of the problems we have here. No matter how much we try to spell it out and break it down, you have forces that are greater than us here who are reinforcing the BS coming out of Donald Trump's mouth. Sean didn't push back on that. How do we know? Well, we didn't see it. Now, I'm sure they didn't edit it out if he did, right? Maybe they did. But that says to me, there was no way. But wait a minute, Mr. President, you're misreading the law here. And you know who was on the phone call. So tell us who was on the phone call. So that's the problem we have in this space right now, Nicole. Despite the incredible reporting by Mike and the legal analysis by Neil, you're still stuck in a political quagmire where a lot of people think Donald Trump is getting screwed here.
I think that is the backdrop for everything as it pertains to Donald Trump. And that's why the pace of sort of the wheels of justice have always been something that we've sort of tried to pull that thread as tautly as we can. But I just want to ask all of you a basic question. What the government recovers are not recently declassified documents. They're 184 classified documents, 67 confidential, 92 secret, 25 top secret. Even the stuff he gave back wasn't deemed declassified by him or anybody else. In June, he handed over 38 still classified documents. So when he says at an event, I declassified everything I had, he didn't even declassify the things that he had. And you would imagine sheepishly, but I guess he's not capable of that. So of the 38 classified he turns back, 5 are confidential, 16 secret, 17 top secret. August 8th, when the judge approves a search by the FBI, they go in and find 103 more still classified documents. I mean, he'd been moving them around all over like a, you know, prepping for a yard sale, but he hadn't bothered to declassify any of them. And 54 secret and top secret were among them. So the other piece of this that is, and I take Michael Shill's point that it may all be lost on the public. I think the public's getting a pretty unbelievable education. And I think when they hear Bill Barr, every time he's in front of a camera, plead the case for DOJ for reasons that aren't clear to me that this is as serious as a heart attack, they're at least hearing from sort of across the information spectrum that what was recovered and given back was still classified, Neil.
Absolutely. And I think that's where the prosecution would lie. And Michael Steele is absolutely right that there's a whole counter narrative, but that's what we have jury trials for. And that's ultimately what I think Jack Smith will conclude, which is, look, there's a debate in the popular press about whether or not Donald Trump did something wrong or not. We as lawyers, we as national security officials know if this were anyone else, it's an obvious, easy indictment. I mean, you know, those are hundreds of documents, Nicole, you just flashed her. I don't know if Donald Trump did he leave anything left at the White House for his archives, or did he just take the whole thing? I don't know, but it's not like one stray document or something like that. It's a whole series of them. And then you've got the added problem that after the archives asked them and after the prosecutors asked to turn over documents, they said they turned everything over when they hadn't. And that's when they found so many more classified and sensitive documents. And sure, Trump can say he declassified stuff in his mind, but that is obviously not what the documents are marked and say. And declassification is a, you know, extensive process that you go through. And when you have a declassified document, it's marked as such at the top and bottom of the page. None of that existed here. And, you know, the whole point of declassification and to make it difficult is to protect our sources and methods, is to protect information our allies have given us. Some of those, you know, lives may have been lost to generate that information. And so it's a really serious thing to declassify a document. It's certainly not something that happens right when you walk out with a document, even if you're the president of the United States. There's not a word in the Presidential Records Act that says anything like what Donald Trump is saying. And that's why the only person advising him as such is the guy who I think doesn't even have a law degree. But that's the person who is advising Donald Trump on this, you know, cockamamie legal theory.
Mike, you're a student of the president's migration over the 4 years to the presidential powers that were absolute, like the pardon or near absolute, which is declassification. But there's something about his authority to declassify that he misses, even in his public defenses of his conduct. And that's that. And maybe unlike the pardon, there's a tail. Sue Gordon has explained it, that while he could declassify things, it's not just by thinking it. There's an actual process where when it's human intelligence, it goes back to the CIA and it gets distributed to allies that it's been declassified to save lives, sources, and methods. If it signals intelligence and he does it, which is incredibly sensitive typically, and he wants to declassify it, he has the power. No saying he did. That isn't while president, but there's a process for that too. There's no paper trail that he actually declassified anything within the process where things end up declassified.
One thing that we do know about what Jack Smith has done is they've taken on one of the other sort of defenses in this area, which was if documents went up to the residence, they were declassified. And they've been able to look into that to find that there was no evidence to support
right.
that. And to basically knock that leg of an argument out. I'm not sure how strong of an argument that would ultimately be, but I know that they drilled down to try and see if there was anything there, and there was nothing that was there. They've tried to understand what he was told about this process so they could establish sort of like, okay, you know, you had been told when you came in, this is how you need to handle these things. This is how this works. Look, Donald Trump obliterated norms and in the process, a lot of processes. And I think that he obviously never appreciated the fact that when he left office, he was no longer president. And he started and he continued to behave in ways as if he still had powers that he didn't have. And look, as president, he behaved in ways that he thought he had powers that he didn't have.
Do we know when, I think the Times and others have reported that Chairman Mark Milley has been in to talk to Jack Smith prosecutors. I don't know if we know if it's just the prosecutors or if he's been before the grand jury. Do we know when that was? Do we know if that was about this tape?
Do we know when it was or what it was about?
Either.
I'm not sure if we know either of those things. Milley is someone that, if you were Jack Smith, you would probably want to have one meeting with him. You wouldn't want to have to bring him back and forth.
Right.
And given the fact that he's an important witness on January 6th,
right.
he's certainly someone you would want to talk to for that investigation. So did they deal with both of those matters at the same time? You know, dating back to the Mueller investigation, they didn't want to have to be dragging people of significance back and forth. I certainly don't think they would want to be doing that with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Right.
So you would probably think that Milley talked about January 6th as well, because, you know, based on what we know, Milley as a witness probably knows far more about Trump's conduct on January 6th than he does about the documents.
It's all still intriguing to us on the outside. Neil Katyal, Mike Schmidt, thank you both so much for starting us off on this. Michael Steele sticks around for the hour. When we come back, Governor Ron DeSantis, or DeSantis, depending on the day, is campaigning all throughout New Hampshire, talking about his favorite thing, so-called wokeness and defunding diversity programs, and touting his losing fight with Disney. We're not sure why, but he does seem to have a reptilian political instinct that's alive enough to run away from one of his most extreme positions, why he's avoiding his own six-week abortion ban any which way he can while campaigning there. We'll show you that. Plus, could prosecutors in Georgia be expanding their investigation into the ex-president? New reporting on that case also coming up. And later in the broadcast, two women who stood up to and continue to stand up to the ex-president, E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump, will join us together on their new project. All those stories and much, much more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Ron DeSantis, or if it's Friday, he could be going by DeSantis today. We can't keep it straight around here. When you find yourself in a hole, though, this is true for all politicians in both parties. Like Ron, should we say duh today? DeSantis is right now. With all but a sliver of the whole American electorate that's available, the first thing any politician, again, any party should stop doing is to stop digging. But the Florida governor doesn't do that very often, except in this one spot. For instance, in his first trip as a presidential candidate to New Hampshire this week, he completely avoided talking about his six-week abortion ban. He did that as though his political future depended on it, which in some ways maybe it does. But on his favorite topics, which are also highly unpopular with the whole electorate, culture wars, wars on schools and books and teachers, DeSantis kept on digging. You might remember last month, the NAACP issued a travel advisory for the state of Florida, citing the governor's war on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Yesterday, DeSantis responded after talking about the benefits of school choice. He insisted, quote, if you're in Baltimore or Chicago, these kids have a better chance of getting shot than getting a first-class education. We spoke yesterday about the growing coalition of the sensible, people who see book bans and rewriting of history for what both those things are, anti-democratic and anti-American policies for an entirely fabricated problem, wokeness. Today, the coalition grows. First, a group of nine governors signed onto a letter directed at some of our nation's largest textbook companies, urging them not to give in to censorship-related or motivated demands. Plus, in an inherent rejection of the DeSantis agenda, a new Moms Rising poll reveals that 94% of likely mom voters support teaching the good and the bad of our history. 82% say children learn best when they feel safe to be themselves. And 78% of moms reject all book bans. Joining us at the table, our friend Randy Weingarten. She's president of the American Federation of Teachers. Michael Steele still with us. The last time you two were together, it was just epic. So I'm going to get out of the way in a second, but I want to show both of you something. We had first reported on this earlier in the week. This is a very red county in Florida, like a plus 41 DeSantis county last time he ran. 50 teachers have quit. Let me show you what one of the teachers said was the reason why.
No one is teaching your kids to be gay. Sometimes they just are gay. I have math to teach. I literally don't have time to teach your kids to be gay, even if I cared enough to. I don't. I want to teach them literacy and numbers. Numeracy, if you will. If you've spent time in a classroom, you'd know it's hard enough to get your kids to put their name on their papers. We do not have the power to change a part of them that has always been part of them. Students don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Every single one of them. Gay, straight, black, white, Asian, trans, all of them. And I love them all. exactly as their weird little selves are.
I mean, I said the other day I would try to find a way to play that every day. It's just a beautiful, beautiful mission statement for the life of a teacher.
Right. I mean, that's who teachers are. And in that county, and I just have so much awe because they decided with teachers from around different counties who were there to support them, that they were going to stand up this week, that it was enough. Mm. And it's not simply that we are losing so many teachers in Florida, but people want to teach. And just like that teacher said, like, give me a break. The people who are trying to indoctrinate are the ones who are accusing us.
Right.
But if you think about, and it's great that we're seeing all these new data points that show what we saw 2 years ago, which is people want teachers to have the latitude to care about their kids and to deal with learning loss and to deal with all the stuff that happened in COVID. And if you restrict teachers' latitude to do that, a kid is going to see that in a minute. And so what's happened in Florida is that people feel like they are in a vice, like they are trapped, like they want to answer kids' questions, but they don't know if they're going to get fired. They want to have a classroom library, but they don't know if they're going to be fired. And the people in Florida who are more mad than anyone else are the people who voted for DeSantis because they feel completely betrayed, because they bought that he said, this is about freedom. And this is about repression and trying to stymie not only knowledge, but growth and aspiration.
You know, Michael Steele, I've covered this school board meeting earlier in the week, and it reminds me of Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society, which makes me weep just talking about Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. But the fact that the right has stripped the humanity out of parenting, the fact that this has to be said, the fact that any teacher has to say this sentence, no one is teaching your kids to be gay. Sometimes they just are gay. Do you think that that's actually an open question on the right, or is this all performative?
I think the vast majority of it is performative. It is particularly by the politicians like DeSantis who are playing to fears and grievance and a whole bunch of other things. Because I can assure you, there are gay children in Republican families. there just are. I mean, I don't know why they're acting like, you know, their kids. I mean, the teacher who educated, you know, your child who happens to be gay, turn that kid gay? No, they didn't. And that was the point that this teacher was trying to make, was that we accept kids in the classrooms as they are. Not as you want them to be, or even sometimes as their parents want them to be, right? We get to see them in their rawness. We get to see them learn and grow and deal with stuff that most adults don't want to deal with.
Exactly right.
And children are dealing with this issue a hell of a lot better than their parents and the adults in the community. And that, I think, is what makes it so much harder for teachers. When I was lieutenant governor, I took a year to study our educational system in Maryland. And when I put this effort together, I remember telling the staff, I don't want to sit down in some focus group with the teachers union and parents and all these other professionals. I want to see education the way kids see it. Mm-hmm. I want to see it through the eyes of a child. So guess what? As lieutenant governor of Maryland, I was standing at a school bus stop at 5 a.m. to catch a school bus to class, to make the rounds, to get there by 7:30, right? Mm-hmm. And then had lunch at 10 a.m. and didn't have anything else to eat the rest of the day. And so going through that experience that kids go through and listening to their experience from the moment they're at the school bus at 6 o'clock in the morning to the time they leave after at the end of the day, that's the focus here. And in that period, Nicole, is where the teacher does her magic.
Yeah.
And that magic is not confounding. It's not, you know, unprecedented. It is very simple and basic. She listens. She teaches. She listens some more. She teaches. And education is not just what they find in a book. It's not just what they're being told. It's how they experience it. And so many of these idiots are ruining this experience for these kids, because you know who's also affected by this? The friends of gay and trans kids who are watching their friends be treated and pushed around and denied their humanity by adults. And so how are they processing that? And that for me is what's so sickening and sad about what Ron DeSantis in his BS wokeness is all about right now. And any other political leader out there who's signing on to this crap. You're not just hurting the kids that are trans and gay, you're hurting their friends as well.
I want to ask both of you about whether this is a political moment like last spring, where after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, there was a sense that that was the political peak and that it would recede before the elections. And I remember saying, and Joy Reid said it too, no. This will peak and peak and peak and peak every time a woman dies because she can't get health care, or every time a woman's baby is not viable and she can't make decisions with privacy and dignity. This will peak and peak and peak. And I want to press both of you on whether we're at sort of the beginning of the beginning with these policies, where you have, you know, famous people like Dwayne Wade saying, I'm leaving because my family's not safe in Florida. But now you've got it really rippling out through the country, and you get a Republican Party that's going to go bang the drum on intolerance. I'm going to give you 2 minutes to think about it, but I want to have that conversation next. No one's going anywhere.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
We're back with Randy and Michael. I mean, I want to ask you this question that I posed before the break. I mean, do you see and are you hearing and are you buoyed by the fact that most families really revere and depend on teachers, and that the overreach is just not connecting with the vast majority of American families?
Yes. And I mean, I think it's what we've been seeing this year is what, frankly, I saw right before the November 2022 elections, which is that most people weren't buying it. They want their kids to be okay. And they want us to deal with learning loss, and they want us to deal with mental health, and they want people to be better. And we're not even talking about things like ChatGPT and all that other AI and mental health. And so they want us to spend the time in schools having enough teachers, enough support, working together to help their kids. But what all of this, what DeSantis does, is because this is the constant diatribe, the constant grievance, the constant hatred, it makes it hard for individual teachers and for school boards and principals to actually do the right thing. They want to, but they're being very, very quiet about it, as opposed to doing what we need to do to actually move a mental health agenda, move an experiential learning agenda, have the books that kids want to read and enjoy, the sports they want to do together. And so everybody is on tender hooks. And right. That's what this dehumanization has done. It feels like you have to have courage to go to a school board meeting rather than simply saying, let's do what's right for kids. Let's do what we need to do to help teachers help kids.
You know, Michael, there's something in the sort of campaign vibe, and I know Youngkin did this and is viewed on the right as having done this successfully, that is abstract when you're targeting a woke agenda. But there's something that everyone can relate to, and the on the ground cruelty of targeting the family of a trans kid or targeting a gay teacher. I mean, I would like to think that we live in a country where that is more unpopular and offensive than celebrated and popular in terms of fueling a political movement. What do you think the effect is now that some of these things have been on the books long enough to see the actual human beings harmed by them?
Well, that's going to be a very important tell about which direction all of this goes and how it plays out. I think I'm just going to go out on a little bit of a limb here. I'm kind of, that's what I do.
That's why we love you.
And say that from my experience, again, having spent time pretty knee deep in education, even having taught when I was a seminarian in high school, taught high school. School board meetings are not a thing until someone takes something out of context and blows it up and makes it a thing.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. A lot of the parents who are bitching and screaming and you know, the 11 parents that have now amassed the banning of over 1,000 books, right? 11 parents. Go back and ask them, how many school board meetings do you go to every year? How many times have you been? Because the parents who are involved and attend those meetings, they know what's going on. They know what's happening in the classroom. But they're not afraid of the knowledge that's being imparted to their kids because they are on the front lines with those teachers in helping those kids process through all of that, to experience that. The ones who aren't there, the ones who are agitated and loudmouthed, are the ones who haven't been at school board meetings, who don't attend PTAs, who don't even necessarily go on parent teachers night, right? And yet they are exercised when someone puts out a conspiracy theory that, you know, that teacher's turning your kid gay. And they don't even know what teacher. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They get excited. So hopefully what we see now is that the politicians who are clueless and weak need to begin with when it comes to these things, because God forbid they actually tell parents, no, this is not what you think it is. If they, now that they're passing these laws, Nicole, what's happening is parents are beginning to see, very much in the same vein as Dobbs. Mm-hmm. Now they're beginning to see this thing play out. And going back to what Randy and I were talking about in the last segment, how this is impacting every child, not just the ones that are being
correct.
Targeted.
Right. Correct. And every teacher, you know, I mean, I think, yeah. And I mean, I want to come back to the other policy, which is, I think, the most unpopular of all in sort of this new moms group. And the polling that's out is the book ban.
Exactly right.
I mean, Gavin Newsom and other officials are trying to sort of counter
Two things are really unpopular: the book bans, and also, why would you get rid of social emotional learning when we have a mental health crisis? And when we have to make sure that kids feel okay.
And when your reason for doing nothing about guns in America is it's a mental health problem.
So it's just, if it wasn't so serious, it'd be laughable. But the book bans, what's happening is that parents are saying, and Michael got it right, 11 parents in Florida have been responsible for 60% of the book bans. And it was only when the Amanda Gorman ban, and that person didn't even read it and had elders in Zion on her Facebook page. So the craziness here is people are starting to feel the deprivation and they're getting really angry, just like on Dobbs. There's a sense that you are taking something away from my child.
Right. It's regressive.
Because you're doing this. Why are you doing this? Why are you taking this away from my child? Why don't you let my child and her teacher decide what's right? And the other thing I'll say is there are processes to figure out curriculum. We don't get it right all the time. But use those processes that the school boards are supposed to have. That's why we have lay boards that are voted on by parents in the main.
What do you think about? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Can I just pick up on something that Randy said? I just don't want people to lose a point that may be too subtle for some. and that is,
love you, Michael.
it ain't woke to emotionally support our children.
Yes.
All right. It ain't woke to make sure that they have a sound learning environment. it ain't woke to recognize that a kid who's going through the travails of life is going to need, in addition to all the book smarts that you want to provide them and pass on to them, the emotional stability to deal with the life that they're going to have to encounter when they're not in the classroom. And a lot of times that's when they leave at 3 p.m., right, to go home, because the home is a hot mess. And the teacher sees that every day, too, and has to deal with that every day, too. And now you're laying on top of that things that take away that emotional support that that teacher can provide them as they're discovering their sexuality and their parents aren't dealing with it very well, as they're discovering and dealing with a learning disability that parents have checked out on or don't even know is there because they're not paying attention to the child and what's happening. They just think it's behavioral. It's not. It's because they can't read the right way. So all of these things are what our teachers are confronting every day. And we don't want to pay them for that. We don't want to provide them the resources to deal with that. We just want to lump them into some woke bucket that says they're trying to groom their kids to be something that they're not, other than good, decent human beings.
I want to give you the last word. And what I was about to ask you is about becoming this incredibly brutally targeted public official from people on the right. Mike Pompeo, we've talked about it, called you, quote, the most dangerous person in the world. Others are relentless in attacking you. You represent teachers. What is that like?
So, you know, I can analyze it and I can feel it. As most people know, I am a gay woman. I was probably the first out education official, as well as the first out labor leader. And that was pretty scary because, of course, all the groomer and pedophile and all that stuff was said at that time, you know, it's or thought. And what I do now, and I'm also married to a rabbi, so it's the anti-Semitism issue, it's the woman's issue, it's the gay issue. They check a lot of boxes when they try to dehumanize me. So what I now do is say, okay, you want to smear me? Be my guest. You're not going to stop me from doing the work I have to do to lift people and to have a better life for people. And the more they smear me now, the more I just kneel right into the work. And
that's incredible.
And I just feel like, fine, you're really that afraid? You're that afraid of the trans kid? You're that afraid of the gay person who's getting married to the guy he loves? You're that afraid of knowledge? Shame on you. And part of what you did for me last, just to be very, you know, just for a moment, what you did with Michael that last time, it was really affirming. And so many people told me they saw that moment, because here's Michael, the Republican lieutenant governor, Randy, the Democrat, and we are sitting there with you talking about how to fight dehumanization.
Is it going to make me cry? I feel like we need to come. You got to come up here. And I think this is, you know, we can chop it into the buckets, right, of Roe and of the woke agenda. But I think it is at its core, the strategy of dehumanization. And I think we should sit here and try to solve for that and figure that out. And that was all Michael Steele. But thank you very much for lumping me in with a compliment. Randy and Michael, love you both. Thank you so much. We will be right back. Thank you. A few hours from right now, President Joe Biden will speak from the Oval Office to the nation, heralding Congress for sending the bipartisan budget agreement to his desk to sign. That's after passing the Senate last night on a 63-36 vote. It, of course, prevents the country from what would have been its first ever default and extends the debt ceiling for two more years. The debt limit deal marks a massive victory for President Joe Biden, and MSNBC will carry the president's remarks live from the Oval Office tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern. When we come back, there are new details on the possible widening scope of Fannie Willis's criminal investigation down in Georgia into the ex-president's efforts to overturn his defeat there. Very short break for us today. Don't go anywhere.
No, the numbers are the numbers. The numbers don't lie. We had many allegations, and we investigated every single one of them. In fact, I challenged my team, did we miss anything? Every single allegation we checked, we ran down the rabbit trail to make sure that our numbers were accurate. We just followed the law, and we followed the Constitution. And at the end of the day, President Trump came up short.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. It was that simple. He came up short. Trump didn't win the state of Georgia in the 2020 presidential election. His claims of fraud were wrong. They were debunked. Georgia performed multiple recounts, and they all arrived at the very same conclusion. Trump lost, didn't have enough votes to win. That, of course, didn't and doesn't matter to the now twice impeached, indicted, liable for sexual abuse and defamation, disgraced ex-president who tried to overturn his defeat in the state of Georgia, who pressured on a phone call Georgia's Secretary of State to find the exact number of votes he needed to reverse his defeat there. Those efforts by the ex-president have been under criminal investigation by Fulton County DA Fonnie Willis for more than 2 years now. And according to brand new reporting in The Washington Post, there is a fresh sign that prosecutors may be building a sprawling case under Georgia's racketeering laws. The Post reports this, quote, among Willis's latest areas of scrutiny is the Trump campaign's expenditure of more than $1 million on two firms to study whether electoral fraud occurred in the 2020 election. The two individuals with knowledge of the probe said. The Washington Post first reported earlier this year that the work was carried out in the final weeks of 2020, and the campaign never released the findings because, wait for it, the firm Simpatico Software Systems and Berkeley Research disputed many of Trump's theories and could not offer any proof that he was the rightful winner of the election. In recent days, Willis's office has asked both firms for information, not only about Georgia, but about other states as well. Trump contested the 2020 election result in Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. RICO experts, that's racketeering laws, say it is unlikely Willis will seek indictments for people regarding actions that happened outside the borders of the state of Georgia. But the Post does report this, quote, evidence and actions from outside the state, such as Trump's statements from Washington that inspired some of the rioters and parallel efforts to overturn other states' results, could be presented as additional evidence that helps establish the pattern. Last month, we got a glimpse into possible timing for Fonnie Willis to bring charges. New York Times reported this. Willis has taken the unusual step of announcing remote work days for most of her staff during the first 3 weeks of August, asking judges in a downtown Atlanta courthouse not to schedule trials for part of that time, suggesting that she is expecting a grand jury to unseal indictments during that time period. Another investigation into Donald Trump's conduct seemingly inching closer to charges is where we begin the hour with Democratic Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. She served on the January 6th Select Committee. Congresswoman, a lot of what we know exists as evidence of the fake electors scheme and the plot out in the states. We know from your investigative work. And the committee did such a meticulous job of putting of illustrating or showing through evidence that Trump sat atop that chain of command with his lieutenant Eastman under it, making farcical legal arguments that even Eastman seems to admit were untrue, and Rudy Giuliani sort of captaining the statewide teams. Tell me what you think his criminal exposure is on the state plots to overturn individual defeats of his.
Well, I'm not an expert on Georgia's RICO statutes, but clearly he was at the center, he being the ex-president, of a wide-ranging conspiracy to overturn the election. And some of those actions were connected to Georgia. We've all heard his phone call with the Secretary of State, where he tells him to find the votes he didn't have so he could win the state. Certainly, he knew that the election was not fraudulent. He'd been told that by his own people in the Department of Justice. And I assume that they're looking at these studies that were commissioned, which I didn't know about until after the January 6th committee had concluded its work, as further evidence that he knew that there was no fraud. In fact, Giuliani himself said he didn't have the evidence that there was fraud.
The committee produced that, I think, in a conversation with Mr. Bowers of Arizona. Do you have any doubt in your mind that the plot to overturn the election was quite advanced in multiple states, like where Mr. Bowers was in Arizona, as well as Georgia and others?
Certainly. I mean, we laid out the evidence in our report in various states where he was pressuring members of the legislature. He was in Arizona pressuring the Speaker of the House, calling in legislators to meet with him from other states, trying to get them to throw out the votes in those states. So this was a multi-state, multi-pronged effort to overturn the election. It's pretty scandalous.
Congresswoman, let me play Trump on January 2nd. And this call with Raffensperger, I remember listening to it as soon as it broke that Sunday night. It was such an extraordinary week, right? The night it comes out, I think it comes out the next night, the 3rd, of course, then we're walking up to the eve of the special election and then the insurrection itself. But let me just bring us all back in time to Trump on January 2nd, ahead of the insurrection, threatening Brad Raffensperger.
You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a, you know, that's a criminal, that's a criminal offense. I watched you this morning, and you said, "Well, there was no criminality." But I mean, all of this stuff is very dangerous stuff. When you talk about no criminality, I think it's very dangerous for you to say that.
What do you think he's saying there? I mean, it clearly sounds like it's dangerous. Dangerous? Why?
Well, he was threatening the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State testified to our committee that he did feel that this was a threat to him. At some point, he said, you know, you could be in criminal trouble if you don't do what the ex-president wanted. So it's an effort to get the Secretary of State to to make up votes that didn't exist. And luckily, he understood that his job was to deliver the votes that were actually cast, not fake votes from the voters.
What's interesting to me is that the conventional wisdom on the Jack Smith probes is still that Mar-a-Lago is open and shut. You got Bill Barr out there. You can't get between Bill Barr and a camera before he wants to tell you how much deep doo-doo Trump is in on Mar-a-Lago. But the evidence created, and especially in the transcripts that came out at the Select Committee's conclusion, there's such specificity about the state. Yeah. Efforts. And there's so many people involved. It's a massive conspiracy. There's slates of fake electors. There are voicemen. I mean, these people weren't careful criminals. They weren't as smart as Stringer Bell. They put all of their conspiracies in writing and they left them on voicemails. Where do you hope that investigation is by Jack Smith?
Well, I don't know where it is. Certainly, we delivered all the evidence that we had, which was substantial. Of the various efforts, and I think it was a wide-ranging conspiracy to overturn the election. I'm sure that the special counsel is looking at all the evidence and, doesn't want to bring charges unless he feels a high level of confidence that he can prove to a jury this criminal conduct beyond a reasonable doubt. It's been a long time. I understand he has to be careful, but I think the sooner he reaches a conclusion, either to indict or if he thinks he can't, not to indict, the country would be better off. We need a conclusion on this.
Let me play one more piece of sound from the Select Committee's investigative work about John Eastman, because there's not a lot of noise around the Eastman investigation either. And his conduct was so brazen and seemingly in rooms full of many people and on emails with many people. And then I want to bring Mary McCord and Katie Benner in. Let me play you this first.
We had an extended discussion, an hour and a half to 2 hours on January 5th. And when I pressed him on the point, I said, John, if the vice president did what you were asking him to do, we would lose 9-0 in the Supreme Court, wouldn't we? And he initially started it, well, I think maybe you would lose only 7-2. And after some further discussion, acknowledged, well, yeah, you're right, we would lose 9-0.
Congresswoman, my question for you is, when you see news that NBC is reporting that the Georgia grand jury recommended indictments for more than a dozen people in the Trump probe, and you take remind sort of our viewers that it was a federal judge out in California looking at, I think, some documents requests from the committee who said it was more likely than not that Eastman and Trump committed felonies. That was a quote, committed felonies. Would you be surprised if Eastman was not one of the individuals indicted by Fannie Willis?
Well, I don't know what she's doing, but certainly Judge Carter found that the two of them more likely than not committed crimes. Eastman knew that the position he was espousing was not lawful. And your quote there was the little clip where he would lose 9-0. He knew that. He was trying to foist off on the ex-president a scheme that was not lawful to overturn the election. I don't think that's a lawful action, honestly. So we'll see.
All right. I want to bring into our conversation New York Times reporter and MSNBC contributor Katie Benner. She's covered this prong of the Georgia conduct since before the Select Committee existed, since the Senate Judiciary Committee was actually looking into some of the DOJ-specific functions. Also joining us, former Acting Assistant Attorney General for National Security and MSNBC legal analyst Mary McCord is here as well. Katie, I remembered your reporting, and if I have any of this timeline wrong, please correct me, but before there was a Select Committee doing all their incredible investigative work, wasn't it the Senate Judiciary Committee that was first interviewing some of the ex-DOJ officials, and some of the evidence that they developed early on was about Rosen and Donahue standing up to and confronting Jeffrey Clark, who, among other things, wanted to meddle in the Georgia results after Bill Barr and others had told Trump it was the B word, BS.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the interesting things about the work that the committee did in the Senate is that they pressed Rosen, they pressed Donahue, then the acting numbers one and two at the Justice Department at the end of the Trump administration, whether or not they felt that Donald Trump had committed a crime. And they said, you know, in their meetings with him, he actually did take their advice eventually, which was when they advised him to do the legal and right thing, including not installing Jeffrey Clark at the top of the Justice Department. But they also said again and again that they weren't really sure what Clark was up to, and they felt it very disconcerting that he had so much access to real information and accurate information about the fact that the election was not stolen, but that he was still conspiring and working with others in the White House and around the White House to try to do something they knew that was not only untrue, but potentially unlawful. So, you know, it was really early indication that there was going to be legal problems down the road for Jeffrey Clark. And now fast forward, Jeffrey Clark right now in Washington, D.C., there's a fight over whether or not he's going to lose his bar license. And in some of his own filings, he's wanted to delay those hearings, saying, I'm under criminal investigation in these other matters, which is why I think we should delay deciding whether or not my license is revoked. And he says he believes he's going to win. Of course, we need to say that, too. But he's now he's conceded in these other public forums that he is certainly in legal hot water.
Mary McCord, Mark Meadows goes down to Georgia. Jeffrey Clark is internally obsessed with Georgia. Rudy Giuliani is actually being sued for defamation in a case that's making its way through the federal courts by Seamus and Ruby Freeman for peddling a conspiracy theory for which there was never any evidence and likening them to drug dealers. They were, based on Congresswoman Lofgren's investigative work, sharing a ginger mint. That's what they were passing among each other, not a zip drive. How do you evaluate the criminal exposure in Georgia by Fannie Willis for those individuals?
Well, with the caveat that I'm not an expert on Georgia criminal law, you know, there are so many facets of this. If we just take what you just indicated in terms of different players in this conspiracy, we've got, you know, pressure on Brad Raffensperger to find the 11,870 votes. We've got pressure on the state legislature to essentially overrule the will of the voters in Georgia and send up a different slate of electors. Pressure on the electors themselves, the Trump electors, to go ahead and meet fraudulently because their candidate didn't win and to cast their electoral votes and send those votes to Vice President Pence. And then don't forget also, there's allegations of potential tampering with some of the voting apparatus and election equipment in a few counties in Georgia. So there's a lot of exposure here, and it's all about which which people can be connected through the evidence to these various pieces of the conspiracy. And I think that's why we're hearing now about the potential use of racketeering charges and expanding into other states. It's not because Fannie Willis is going to indict a crime that occurred in another state, but if she wants to bring racketeering charges, she's going to want to show a pattern. And she can show a pattern in Georgia alone, but if she shows a pattern across a number of states, as you know, Representative Lofgren was talking about, as Katie was talking about, that's a really powerful case. And it shows there's no mistake here. There's no accident. This was vast. And our piece of it is in Georgia, but it's part of something a lot bigger.
Well, and of course, Mary, Trump couldn't have, what he wanted was to stay in power. He couldn't have stayed in power with just Georgia. So, of course, the plan was rolled out in multiple other states. Right. And as the Congresswoman's work on the committee showed, Rusty Bowers is talk, had they, he testified to Rudy Giuliani saying, well, we don't have any evidence yet. Still, the lies destroy the lives of many Republican Trump supporters there who refuse to manufacture evidence of fraud that doesn't exist. How powerful is evidence that it was the Trump campaign that developed evidence before the Select Committee even existed that fraud didn't exist?
So I think what's so important about that is that, again, we're getting to the intent, because so many of these different aspects, the criminal liability will result, will come from the intent of the actors, right? And I think all along, Trump's been trying to create his own, and you and I have talked about this before, create his own defense of, I truly believed it. I truly believed there was fraud. Therefore, I couldn't have done anything corruptly. I couldn't have made a false statement. I couldn't have urged others to make false statements because I truly believed there was fraud. But the more and more the government can amass objective evidence that he was told over and over again, not just by his own attorney general, not just by his adversaries, but also by companies he hired, his campaign hired, to do a deep dive study and come up with fraud. And those companies knew they were being paid, hoping that they were going to deliver evidence of fraud. And even those companies didn't deliver that evidence. That just gets to be to the point where it would not be credible to a jury to actually believe that Trump honestly, truly believed that he was a victim of fraud. And note also, in some of that evidence that was considered by the judge in California, who found that there was a likelihood of crimes that were committed by John Eastman and Mr. Trump, there was some of that evidence then that suggested that Trump himself admitted at various points that he knew there was not fraud sufficient to change the results.
And Katie, the evidence that you've pointed to, that the DOJ officials who took over for Barr, absent Clark, will say that he ultimately fell into line. A former senior national security official told me that's because he knew he lost. So the reason he ultimately did what they told him to do, whether it was at the Pentagon or DOJ, was because he knew he was leaving and wouldn't have the protections of the presidency.
Well, also, I will say these witnesses, their lawyers, they were very careful. They would say, we, in our conversations, feel that in the end, in our conversations, he did what we told him to do. He took the good advice of counsel. They're always very careful to say that they were not sure what he was doing outside of those conversations. And it's really outside of those conversations where you see Jack Smith's investigation going and where you saw other investigations going, including Fannie Willis's investigation. And I wanted to point out, too, what John Eastman was doing in testimony we saw in reporting that we shared with the public, even before some of these hearings, John Eastman, when he came to Jeff Rosen and he said, I want to try to insert the Justice Department into important state results. Georgia was presented as almost a test case. It was a letter that was going to be written to Georgia from the Justice Department saying, which untruthfully saying, we think that there's evidence of fraud in Georgia. So we're going to need to suspend your results. You can't say that Joe Biden won the election in the state. That letter was presented as a template and that there was an intent to disseminate similar letters in other states. So that, again, when you look at what Fannie Willis is doing, if she wants to show that there was a broad conspiracy and that her state was just a piece of it, that is the sort of evidence that she would want to gather.
It's such an important thing to remember. Georgia was not the full coup. It was just a piece of it. There are not enough electoral votes in Georgia to have successfully overturned a Democratic election result. Congresswoman, I want to give you the last word. The committee was unsubtle in its repetition of everyone from the campaign manager to the campaign spokesperson, to the campaign's data guy. And that's actually the order it goes on election night when you when you work for someone who lost a campaign for president. I've been there. You bring in the campaign manager, and then you bring in the data guy, tell them why they came up short. You bring in the communications guy to tell them, oh, who knows? I mean, that is exactly what happens on a losing campaign. Every single one of them told him he lost. Then you bring in all the lawyers, as Katie's saying. Bill Barr told him it was all BS, that there was fraud. Rudy Giuliani tells Rusty Bowers, oh, we don't have any evidence yet. Even Trump thinks the pillow guy and Sidney Powell are too crazy. I mean, there is no evidence to the contrary that he was ever presented with evidence that his claims of fraud were true.
He had no evidence. Plus, they had over 60 court cases, all of which they lost. So he knew he lost. And he was still trying to overturn it, hold on to power, essentially a coup.
We'll let that be the last word for today. Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, Katie Venner, and Mary McCord, three of the best of the best to have this conversation with. Thank you so much for starting us off. When we come back, predicated on the big lie, there are new voter suppression laws in one of the biggest states in the country, where Republicans are singling out a huge Democratic stronghold in that state in an effort to make it harder for voters to cast their ballots there and near impossible for Democrats to win in the state. Top Democratic voting rights attorney Mark Elias will be our guest to explain what can be done to fight back. Plus, the twice impeached, indicted, and civilly liable for sexual abuse and defamation ex-president is running a campaign that is actually darker than that. Much darker and angrier than anything this nation has ever seen. Later in the hour, two women with a unique perspective onto this campaign of retribution will join us, E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump, on their brand new project. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Republicans in Texas have been busy. This week, they passed more election suppression bills falsely advertised as election reform, including one that further singles out Democratic stronghold Harris County with its own new election policies. It's a county that is more populous than 26 states. It is home to Houston, and a majority of its residents are people of color. It comes just days after they passed another bill that would give power over Harris County elections to the county clerk and county assessor. But this new bill would give Texas's Secretary of State, a Republican, appointed by the Republican governor, the power to remove them and gain sole control over the county's future elections. What could go wrong? From the Washington Post, local officials said it would be unjust to allow the Secretary of State the power to take action against two black women, but not those who hold equivalent positions in the state's 253 other counties. Under the bill, Secretary of State Jane Nelson could oversee elections in Harris County if she found good cause to believe that a recurring pattern of problems with election administration or voter registration existed in the county. Joining our coverage, the founder of Democracy Docket and partner at the Elias Law Group, Mark Elias. Let me read one more piece from the Post story, and then the floor is yours. The Texas Constitution, like those in many states, bars the legislature from passing laws that only apply to specific jurisdictions. The legislation does not mention Harris County by name. Instead, one bill is written to apply to counties of more than 3.5 million and the other to counties of more than 4 million. Harris County is the only county that meets those thresholds. So they violate their own constitution, all in the effort of what? Voter suppression?
Yeah, voter suppression and election subversion. You know, Nicole, you said something in the last segment that I just really think everyone needs to hear, because I was in the room when Hillary Clinton conceded. I was that lawyer at the end of that process you described just before. I was on the phone with John Kerry the early morning in 2004 when he made a decision to concede. And when you see what happened in 2020 and all of the bad actions that are now under criminal investigation, and you see the 65 lawsuits that were filed, my team and I defeated 64 of them by Donald Trump and his allies after the election, including one by Texas to disenfranchise three other states. You can jump forward to what you just asked about in Texas, and there's a through line. Because what Texas wants now is to be able to say, if it doesn't like the election results in Harris County, which is Houston, it's the largest county and a Democratic county, it will just set those aside. And that isn't what you described, what happens. That isn't how we settle Democratic elections in this country. This is the escape valve so that next time they don't have to rely on dunces like John Eastman. And it's really scary.
But how is it passing? I mean, and I know you're playing legal whack-a-mole, but how does it even go into effect? How is it lawful? How is it constitutional to single out one county? I mean, you are really designing the electorate in these Republican supermajority states.
Yeah, it's an extension of what we see with partisan gerrymandering is now just the equivalent of partisan rigging of election results. And so you do that by gerrymandering, you can do that by election rules, and you can do it through election subversion. And the answer to your question, Nicole, is it's not legal, it's not constitutional. But as you say, we play whack-a-mole. Just today, earlier today, the Arizona Supreme Court denied the last-ditch appeal of the Arizona Republican Party to try to throw out mail-in voting in connection with the 2022 election. So great, like we defeated that. You know, I represented the Democratic Party in that and DSCC and the DCCC and great victory. But it is whack-a-mole because there's a lack of a commitment to the legitimate transfer of power that we all have bought into up until very recently. And so we're left with legislatures that pass laws that are clearly unconstitutional, but the burden then falls upon voters or lawyers, like, you know, to go and fight these in court so that we can continue to have a functioning democracy.
But the election fraud movement is like the flat earthers, right? And I remember a Republican calling me after 2020 and said, we started having these conversations right after 2020 election. He said, you're so mean about the election integrity laws. And I said, because there's no fraud. I mean, after the 2000, this is how old I am. After 2000, Jimmy Carter and James Baker were on a commission to look at fraud and they found that there wasn't any. There's no voter fraud. And when there is, there are laws on the books in every jurisdiction, in every state, in every locality to prosecute election fraud when it happens. So this person would say, well, what could you live with? And I said, I couldn't live with any of it because it doesn't exist. You're solving for a problem that doesn't exist. This person obviously didn't give a what I said, because now there are 500 voter suppression laws passed or making their way through 48 states. Is it possible that the opposition to that is too incremental and defensive? I mean, how do you go on offense against 500 voter suppression laws zooming through legislatures predicated on a lie?
Look, I think you asked the big question, because in some ways, you know, I've talked about before that, you know, what I'm trying to do is prevent the worst of the worst from taking place. And as you say, playing whack-a-mole, we're not going to survive as a democracy if that's our only strategy. We need to be, as you say, playing offense in the fight to protect free and fair elections, not just from the process of making it harder to register to vote, but in things like we see now in Texas and elsewhere in literally undermining elections. You know, Republicans have this catchphrase, you know, it's like the fair and balanced, but, you know, of Fox News, which is like gives away the lie. They say they want to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat. What they're doing in Texas is not making it easier to vote. And it's not making it harder to cheat. There is no one who thinks it makes it harder to cheat to divide the election responsibilities in the largest county in the state, one of the largest in the country, between the tax office and the election judge. Like, you want a full-time professional nonpartisan election officials. And that doesn't make it that they're not making the voting better. No one thinks that by letting Greg Abbott, Secretary of State, take over election results in Harris County, you're making it easier to vote or harder to cheat. You're making it easier to cheat when Greg Abbott doesn't like the election results. So we all need to be calling it out every day, which is what you do so incredibly well. But we also need to be activating ourselves to be pro-democracy voters. We can't just be pro-choice voters, pro-climate voters, pro-immigration reform voters. We need to be pro-democracy voters. That needs to be at the top of everyone's agenda.
So we should figure out how we have that conversation as a country, or at least as a show. We're going to drag you up here and maybe some other smart folks like Cornell Belcher and Matt Dowd, because it feels like organically that started to happen in 2022. But and we had it a little bit around the failed push for federal voting rights legislation. But I don't know that there's anything more important ahead of another presidential election where the most secure forms of voting have been eliminated. I mean, drop boxes, right? They're the most secure ballots that exist because of all the signature requirements. And Republicans have gone to war against drop boxes. It's nonsensical. And it's like Seinfeld, the opposite world. But I think we've talked about this.
Yeah, it's not going to get better.
Right. And it takes the truth longer. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, to be continued. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mark Elias.
Thank you.
When we come back, E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump will be our guests. I could stop right there, but I'll tell you what they're here for. They're going to shine a light on what has so far been an extraordinarily dark, dark, dark campaign for the American presidency by the twice impeached, indicted, civilly liable for sex abuse, disgraced ex-president, as well as a really fun and really cool brand new collaboration that they want to tell you about. We'll all be right back.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Mary Trump, as the best expert you can get on Donald Trump, his own relative, could tear down the false image that Trump has created.
Mary Trump has the receipts that provided the basis for the epic Pulitzer Prize-winning expose of the Trump family's financial fraud schemes and tax evasion schemes over the years.
Donald Trump will be forced to give under oath testimony in other civil cases, including the cases brought by E. Jean Carroll and the case brought by Donald Trump's niece, Mary Trump.
For the first time since he was elected president, E. Jean Carroll and her lawyer, Robbie Kaplan, have proven in a court of law that Trump cannot tell lies with impunity. They have done that for the country.
Which makes them, most likely, the two women on the planet the ex-president may be most afraid of, his niece Mary Trump and E. Jean Carroll. But they've now joined forces for a rather unexpected project after battling so much darkness in the form of one ex-president. It's a romance novel, go figure, co-written with Jennifer Taub. It explores the life of an American woman reinventing herself, as we all would like to do, in Italy, as we all would like to do. It is a welcome escape, perhaps a much needed one, as Trump gears up for his third presidential run, which somehow seems to be even darker than the two that came before us. Joining us now, such a pleasure to welcome E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump. The novel is The Italian Lesson. It's coming out on your Substack. Tell me first how this story came to be, and then we'll explain to our viewers some of your limitations on talking about what makes both of you major newsmakers. Mary, you first.
Well, Nicole, first of all, it's great to see you. It's been a while, this is quite an unexpected development, but we actually all met via Twitter DMs after my first book came out in July 2020. And for some reason, maybe because the times were so dark, somebody said half jokingly, let's write a screenplay for a Hallmark movie. And I've never seen a Hallmark movie, but I thought, why not? Nothing came of it, though. And I think the idea was for us to have an excuse to meet, even though we're all incredibly busy. So a few months ago, I had writer's block and I thought, you know what? Instead of a movie, let's write a romance novel, even though I've never read one of those either. And here we are.
E. Jean Carroll, you are someone that we've come to know, not because we've had a ton of chances to talk to you, but because of your legal efforts. I know, and we all know from Roberta Kaplan, that there are real limits on what you can talk about because of the ongoing nature of those. So we won't put you on the spot. But thank you for joining us and tell us about your role in this Hallmark movie that wasn't an expertise, romance novel that wasn't a passion, but this collaborative creative effort.
Well, Nicole, I'm thrilled to be here. And as you can hear, my dogs are even more thrilled.
We love dogs. We love dogs. Let them bark.
I'm happy to look at Mary. I had to put on my glasses to see if I was seeing her right. We're always on the phone, and I rarely get to see her. We're always yakking on the phone. We're always texting, and I only get to see Mary very. And hi, Mary. We're literally on the phone 5-10 times a day. Yeah, so I'm really happy to be here.
Tell me about the story. Eugene, you go first. Yeah.
Well, the story is delicious, and it's unexpected because Mary does not know how to write a romance novel. She is deeply romantic herself, and she's created this wonderful character. And it's a very strange romance novel because Mary Trump is the one who is writing it. And her character, as actually, Nicole, I was thinking as I was putting on makeup for today, I was thinking it'd be interesting if we had a clinical psychologist look at this romance novel. I think she could discover a lot about the author. And then I remember, wait, Mary is a doctorate, has a doctorate in clinical psychology. But I am telling you, the story, it sends me into raptures, as a romance novel should. And I can't wait to turn the pages. And I'm going to give you a hint right now. Mary is devious. And some of the plot is making you look in one direction when Mary is pulling a fast one going in this direction. So I'm warning you, it is a great ride.
Mary, how much of this was to bury your mind and your spirit, maybe more importantly, in something other than your Uncle Donald Trump?
It's a huge motivation, Nicole. And honestly, the greatest motivation is the friendships that this group formed during the height of the COVID lockdown, the second or third COVID lockdown. And, you know, this happened in the context of a time when we were all isolated, but there was this very purposeful attempt to divide us even further. And these friendships became a lifeline. And the idea of being creative with these people and having an excuse to talk to them on the phone 5 or 10 times a day was the reason I did it. I would not be writing a romance novel by myself. I mean, I've been writing fiction for a long time, but, you know, again, I've never read a romance novel. I was motivated by the idea of the collaborative process, and it's exceeded my expectations. And we're also, we call it an experiment in friendship and in romance novels because I don't know the convention. So apparently, according to Eugene, I'm breaking all of them. And we're also serializing it. So we can't really tell you too much about the story because we're only releasing a little bit of it at a time in the hopes of people, you know, people having a chance to see if they're hooked, if they want us to keep going. And we're just really excited about it because, again, the backstory of Backstory Serial is how we came together and what we've made together.
I mean, I think there's something so universal in the connections. And I mean, I have wondered, as you've both been bludgeoned by Donald Trump reputationally and personally and on his various tools of amplification, Twitter, now whatever it is, Truth Social, such an ironic name, what the networks are. And I mean, I think you just told that story to all of us that there are not very many people who can understand what it's like to be attacked by. I remember where I was standing when he called me a dog on Twitter. I mean, there's this thing that's impossible to describe. And it's always, it's never just an attack. You're always an animal. Dog usually is what he called me. I mean, there's something that no one can understand and no one's been attacked by him like the two of you. I mean, Eugene, can you just speak to what this connection and what these friendships have meant to you over the last few years?
Well, they simply meant everything, everything. My friends keep me strong. And they, Mary makes me laugh. And Mary, one time I was talking to Mary on the phone on my way home. And guess what, Nicole? I ended up in Bear Mountain State Park, 70 miles away from my house because I couldn't, we were so excited plotting this book. and going 65, you know, so this is, well, friendship makes life worth living, right? And writing this book is such a treat. And it's, just makes my heart sing.
I'm so, so happy to hear that your heart is singing. Because you are experts, though, in what the country is still contending with, I'm going to ask both of you to stick around. And I want to ask you what we should be girding for and what sorts of friendships we should shore up to survive it on the other side of a break. Don't go anywhere. We are so happy to be back with E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump. Mary, the book deals with, it is delicious, as E. Jean said, but there's some darkness and light, as all human life and the human experience showcases. Not so with Donald Trump. And a lot of what we know about his pathological darkness, we know from your books and the opportunities we've had to interview you. Miraculous, I don't even know the adjective to use, but there is something so extremely deviant about this new run for the presidency. I mean, Make America Great Again was a throwback. It was racist. It was a dog whistle. But I Am Your Retribution is like a Hollywood monster mash. What should the country be prepared for as he prepares to run a third time?
You know, Nicole, when I was thinking about being on the show today, I just kept thinking, you know, plus ça change. We continue to remain mired in this loop where I think a significant minority of people and the entirety of the Republican Party either think something's going to shift or that they're somehow going to escape unscathed. And neither of those things is true. The darkness has always been there. But again, the more he gets away with, the darker it gets, the more he's enabled, the darker it gets. And let's face it, I don't know that it matters that he is to some degree finally being held to account, because I think on the one hand, that increases his street cred for some of his followers. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, regardless, he will be, unless something happens, the Republican nominee for president of the United States in 2024.
Mary, what do you think he means when he says, "I am your retribution"?
He means he's his retribution, because right, as has been well established, and as you well know, he doesn't care about anybody else. This is all his grievance, his pain, his need to fight back. And, you know, with all of the cards in his back pocket, by the way, with all of the help he needs, it is his desire to undo whatever damage he believes has been done to him. So this is a person, and I, it's shocking to me in some ways that we still need to have this conversation, but we do. I was saying this in 2020, there's no bottom. There is nothing he won't stoop to. There is nothing he won't reach for. And if it means bringing everybody down with him, if he thinks he's going down, that's what's going to happen.
E. Jean, the only person to lay a glove on him in the legal arena is you. And again, I know from your attorney that there's nothing you can talk about in that arena. But I wonder what you've heard from other victims of sexual abuse or defamation that, you know, fuels you to sort of continue to reach and work toward the light and these creative projects, and whether there's any sort of full circle experience in hearing from other victims of sexual abuse who watched your trial and watched how it was covered and watched how it ended.
Nicole, you would be amazed. Not only me, but Robbie Kaplan, my brilliant attorney. We have received an avalanche of letters from across the country. And Robbie and I are right now talking about creating a new platform and making it possible for women to come forward. The very act of women coming forward brings power to other women. Mm-hmm. It's the very act of speaking up. And Robbie and I are in serious talks about giving women a platform and giving them legal help. I can't go into it, but it there is help on the way, and by some of the smartest minds in America. And it's going to be brilliant. And it is stunning when you see women speaking up, how much power it gives to other women. Just because I spoke up this little bit, now hundreds of women are writing to us and saying, what can they do and how can they speak up? And we've seen the repercussions already. The woman in California sued Cosby, the woman in New York. It is happening across the country. I would say this is not a downer. This is an upper. And it's we are rising up. And the voices, the stories, Nicole, are breathtaking. They're just breathtaking. Women across the country, they're gathering courage. And I just got to say, watch out.
No, I think it's amazing. And I think, you know, to the people who don't want to see us empowered, that's their greatest fear, right? You have become a magnet for all this. You're now platforming it. I hope you come here and think of us as a media partner with whatever you have up your sleeve. For today, that project is a novel called The Italian Lesson. You can read it on the Substack Backstory Serial over the next year as installments drop. E. Jean Carroll and Mary Trump, what a privilege and a treat. Thank you so much for having this conversation with us. We're grateful. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes for another week of shows. We're so grateful.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.